my favorite time of the month because this episode of the TalkCast Pod Show is brought to you by Boksu. Boksu, delicious Japanese snack. Delicious Japanese snacks sent straight to you from the land of the rising sun. Use the code TEAM4STAR10 at checkout to get 10% off your order. I'm gonna bust through here because Kaiser's conveniently tied up somewhere. This is the sunny Okinawa box for summer. What have we here? It looks like it's gonna be spicy. Aha! Ishiga Kijima chili oil chips. I think I'm gonna dig on this. Oh wow, these are thicker than I expected. Oh hell yeah. It's got like a little tingle, like a lasting burn to it. Like you don't feel it at first, but it's there. It finds you. Okinawa Yukishio Snow Salt Caramel Nut Sable Cookie. Oh, looks like a little ginger snap. Holy crap, that is nutrageous. This delicious salted caramel cookie gets its savory kick from Yukishio or Snow Salt. Snow Salt is a local specialty of Miyako Island in Okinawa.
Oh, that is delightful.
Okinawa exclusive mini Genji pie with Benimo or purple yam is one of many featured ingredients Okinawa is known for. Purple yams are naturally sweet and have a stunning natural color. For this snack, layers of Benimo are folded into a crispy pie dough. Ooh, there's the flavor. It's just beyond like the little pie crust. You get this like lingering sweetness. Yeah, very, very taro-like. Want one of these?
Yeah, I like taro.
Hell yeah. We got Okinawa Island Fruit Drops Hirami Lemon Madeleine. Ooh, it's got like the texture of a Fig Newton, but it's so much better. Like the top part here has this like little jellied lemon flavored, I mean jelly. It's really, you know me, I love citrus stuff, so I'm all about that. Kabukiage rice crackers, Shikwasa salt. These little fried rice crackers are crispy, airy, and deliciously coated with soy sauce and Shikwasa.
Oh yeah, that's got a punch. Bam, right in the face. Hell yeah, oh yeah, I'm loving this box so far.
Oh, what are these little crispy noodle babies? Ah, Okinawa soba. Okinawan chili peppers infused with rice liquor. Oh, hell yeah, gonna get turned.
Much like with the chips, there's that, like, it doesn't hit you with the spiciness at first,
but it comes in there. Like, it lingers in. It takes its time. It gets to know your family first before it burns your tongue. Oh, wow, yeah. Yeah, it really lingers. But I wanna meet them again. Natural yeast bread, Okinawa black sugar. Baked and layered using Okinawa's famously rich black sugar, kokuto. Kaiser, I know you're editing this and you are going to be very mad because this is like, this thing is directly up your alley.
Oh my God, that is really good.
Look at the peel on this, the peel. That's so soft and moist. Oh my God. Matcha and chocolate chip chinsuko. This traditional Okinawan cookie has bittersweet matcha kneaded into the dough and chocolate chips sprinkled throughout.
It's like a shortbread cookie, but with matcha. You get those little pops of chocolate, which, you know, naturally pairs well with green tea. Oh, this box is a definite winner.
Okinawa Kokuto Black Sugar Cookie. Oh man, getting all that black sugar in here.
This is like if you had like a snickerdoodle,
but if you made it with like molasses.
Like a barbecue snickerdoodle. That's like the best way I can describe this. And it's like really aromatic.
I don't even need to read Japanese. It just says cheese. But to be more specific, luxury cafe thyme chinsuko cheese flavor.
I guess that is the cheesiest fucking cracker I've ever had in my life.
Like it's like if you have those Ritz bits, but then you just like skip the middle man. And just make the cheese into the cracker.
Oh, that's good. Oh. Oh, I love cheese.
So thank you again, once again, to our amazing sponsor at Boksu, Team 4-Star 10 at checkout. Delicious Japanese snacks delivered straight to your door.
Now on the TalkCast Pod Show,
Hello and welcome to the TalkCast Pod Show, the number one show on the internet and master of all five elements. I am the voice bender, Lanny Pator, and I'm joined this week by my brother and all-around heart bender, Kaiser Neko. How you doing, buddy?
Aw, that's actually kind of sweet. I like that one.
Well, I'm doing my best. I'm doing my best here with the material provided, which, yeah. So we're here to talk about easily one of my favorite, if not my favorite, cartoons of all time. Like, it's up there with Animaniacs and, like, Batman the Animated Series, Avatar The Last Airbender.
Yeah, if I'm going to be completely honest with you, when a lot of people ask me, hey, what's your favorite anime? I don't particularly personally subscribe to the idea that anime is a genre like some people do, or a movement. So I wouldn't necessarily say Avatar The Last Airbender, but it may be my favorite animated series of all time. Flaws and all.
It's very strong. I mean, it has its off episodes. The Great Divide is notably panned even by the showrunners themselves.
I have some sticking points for this show that are especially relevant now that I've rewatched it twice since it hit Netflix.
It's amazing. The show has done something immense. It has tied for the longest running amount of time that a show has been on the top 10 of Netflix. 57 days, or as I like to call it, two Texas quarantines.
Oh!
Yep.
Winded.
Yeah, pretty heavy blow there. But still, 57 full days in the Netflix top 10.
That's
is
nuts.
Crazy. Only show that it's tied with is Ozark, which I have not seen and know very little about. But it has beaten Tiger King. It has beaten things like Love is Blind, that new Space Force show, 13 Reasons, which I know is huge. Even Stranger Things is not on the list. Although that's maybe because the top 10 didn't exist when Stranger Things was coming out. So,
yeah, maybe it didn't. In fact, I think it didn't.
Yeah,
Either way, it definitely did not.
But still, it's
Avatar set a precedence.
It really has. It has blown away pretty much everything else except Ozark, which
I don't know what that is.
I don't know what that is. Yeah.
But yeah, so oh man. Okay, so can I actually talk about the first time I ever even heard about this show, because I think I heard about it before most people did.
Please do.
So back when I was a kid, a wee lad, I actually had the opportunity to go to the San Diego Comic-Con.
Mm.
Back when they didn't actually have a limit on how many people could go. So I think it was my first year that I went, and I just saw this advertisement for this show, and it was this beautiful piece of artwork of Aang jumping up, like, right above a bunch of Fire Nation soldiers, and all you could see was, like, flames coming up and their weapons trying to stab at him, and he's just laughing like as he's dodging them all.
Mm-hmm.
And it was one of the most gorgeous pieces of artwork I had seen for what was being proposed as an American animated series.
That was made in Korea.
Yeah, yes, it was animated in Korea. And so I was like, what? How is this a thing? And then I noticed that there was a panel about it where the creators were going to show off the pilot. It was the first time the pilot had ever been advertised. So I got excited. I was like, okay, I really need to go see what this is about. So I went and I was blown away. The pilot, if you've not seen it, Katara is called Kaya, but everybody else is named appropriately, and all of the actors are the same except for Aang's. It's animated almost exactly like the show is, but there's one major difference. One thing that they changed that I'm sort of sad about.
What's that?
So the studio that actually animated for the series and the pilot was known for utilizing models, both 3D and traditional, in their animation.
Mm-hmm.
There's this amazing fight scene that happens on a bunch of rafters around a Buddhist statue, and they used 3D technology to help move the environments, and it was really cool. There's a in the
ahead
entire
of its
thing,
time even.
Oh yeah, at the time it was cutting edge technology, and the really cool part about it was, you know, they showed off Aang, Sokka, Katara, Zuko, and those were the I think Iroh might have been there, but I cannot remember 100% certainly. Zuko looks like a dork in this fucking pilot, I'll tell you that. He looks like a total dork. And he also has a pet falcon, which I can see why they got rid of the falcon.
So edgy.
Yeah. Oh, yeah, no. He was... The fucking falcon was so badass looking, and I can see why they got rid of it, because they're like, you know what? We don't think the loner needs a pet. So they just gave him Uncle Iroh to help give him a companion to travel with.
Which, you know, great decision.
Oh, yeah. Iroh's the... Maybe the best character on the show, if I'm going to be really honest.
Very, very possible. Always aim to be like Iroh. Or, at the very least, aim to make Iroh proud.
What would Iroh do?
Yeah, Iroh is like the Mr. Rogers of animation.
Yeah. But so yeah, I saw this pilot, and I freaked out. I could not believe that this was a TV show that I was going to be able to watch. And so... This was in July of the year before it came out, and I got excited, and then nothing, and then nothing. And I'm like, when is this show going to happen? I need this show in my life. And then suddenly I hear November, and I'm like, oh God, yes. And then it aired, and then I was disappointed.
Really?
Yes, I was disappointed with the first episode. I was like, this.
I mean, Boy in the Iceberg is definitely not a strong opening episode for any show. I mean, it's why I feel this show lends itself very, very well to binge watching.
Yeah, a little bit.
Because you can just like plow through some of those episodes that maybe aren't quite as good. But it leads to such amazing moments. I think the show really hits its stride starting in book two. I think that can be widely agreed upon.
It hits its stride there. Not that there aren't good episodes in the first season.
No, of course.
Yeah, you can definitely tell that they're trying to find Sokka's... They're all kind of different characters in a lot of different ways. And you know what? Good thing is, a lot of that can be chalked up to character development, but other parts of it are really just them trying to figure out, okay, how do we want to write Sokka? How do we want to write Katara? What conflicts do we want to give Aang that are going to actually make him more compelling? And also, Zuko as a character in season one is fascinating because you don't know where he, like, how he's going to develop. I wasn't 100% sure when I was young. It's like, okay, is he actually going to become a good guy or is he going to be a bad guy till the end? I think it was
He's by far the most compelling character in the show to me.
Oh, yeah, 100%. He has the best story. Like, in the
Everybody loves a redemption arc.
Yeah. But yeah, that first season is just a lot of setup, a lot of introduction to how the elements work, a lot of world building too.
The biggest thing you'll notice in the first season is that there's a lot more Adventure of the Week elements in the first season because they're introducing you to the world, concepts within the world, while sprinkling in lore about the Avatar and what it really means.
The series never stops being episodic, but yeah, it's especially relevant in that first season where it's like, hey, we're trying just to make our way to the... you know, across the world, and we're stopping these different places. We're going to liberate an Earth Nation prison, or yeah, a Fire Nation Earth prison, and we're going to meet Jet. Jet.
Who just sort of disappears in the second season.
Yeah, he does die. It is confirmed that he dies.
It's implied. It's implied heavily. And they even pointed out in one of my favorite episodes, the one where they go to the play.
The Ember Island Players.
Yeah. And it's like, so did he die? You know, it's really unclear.
Yeah. They do confirm, the creators did confirm, he did die. Mm. But yeah, that was one of the best jokes in the show. Like, legitimately one of the best jokes in the show. But yeah, that first season's a lot is just, I'm glad they brought back some of the stuff that happened in that first season. Like, I'm really glad that, like, hey, all the stuff that happens here is still relevant, but it did feel kind of disjointed, disconnected, and honestly, kind of not as funny as I think they wanted it to be. They were trying to go for this kind of, like, laissez, like, it's really kiddie in that first season.
Yeah, I mean, there are still parts that like hold true. The fortune teller episode is a standout of season one.
Actually, I kind of remember. I don't dislike that episode, but I think my favorite part of it is actually when she asks Iroh if he wants his fortune told, and I think his response is something along the lines of, "At my age, there's only one big surprise left, and I'd rather leave that one."
And I'd rather keep that one a surprise. Yeah, yeah. That's such an Iroh thing.
Yeah, and
my whole favorite part about that is just like Sokka just being like, the conversation of like, you know, mysticism versus science. Like, can your science explain clouds in the sky? Yes, it can.
I do love that because they are in a world where it's like no, magic exists. I mean, it's spirituality, but
it's magic.
Yeah.
I mean, there's literally a portal to the spirit world where a giant bear comes and fucks up a town.
It all depends on what you call magic and what it like. Is it supernatural? Okay. Is it spiritualism?
In this situation, I am going to consider anything supernatural. Let's just call that the realm of magic. Or right. whatever you want to call it.
Mysticism.
I'm just going to use the general term magic. Mysticism works fine as well.
Yeah. A lot of mystical elements. Mm-hmm. Which was really interesting watching through Avatar is like a lot of those mystical elements really show up in season one. Like more than almost any other, like actually as the show goes on, a lot of that mysticism sort of takes a back seat.
Yeah. Yeah, a little bit. I mean, it's still... But it's because it's already been established that it can. And they can focus more on the world politics and what's going on within the interpersonal relationships between the nations.
Yeah. But
Because it never goes away. I mean, even up until the Lion Turtle. Like, that's heavy mysticism.
Yeah. We'll talk about the Lion Turtle later. But, I really enjoyed that. I didn't like the first couple episodes when I was a kid. However, as I watched, I grew into it more and more. And by the end of it, I think when the series 100% officially had me, actually. Like, I was 100% on board, was when Katara fights that northern water tribe. Was it northern or southern?
Northern.
Yeah, the northern water tribe teacher.
Yeah, when she duels him.
That fight is so fucking sick. And it honestly, it also helped because at that point Katara had been not
the healer, she's the white mage.
Yeah, she was not really all that interesting in combat, and they were still trying to find out, okay, what is her element, pun intended, within the group. And then she just comes out swinging against Paku, the fucking ice discs. I was like, holy shit.
And, like, and even though she lost that duel, which, you know, rightfully so, he's a waterbending master.
Yeah.
It still, like, proved him. It's like, fine, you can learn. Like, you know. Hell yeah.
Yeah.
Honestly, Katara has some of the best scenes throughout the entire series. Or at least she's involved in them. Because I think it has a lot to do with the way that the animators animate the waterbending and how much better that looks than so many of the other forms, because it has that flowing movement.
So, well, it's sort of interesting because the way they animate the different elements is sort of, you know, I think they all look good in their own way. But when it comes to the water, you do have this. The really cool thing about the water is that you can do whatever you want with it a bit, because you can freeze it. You can make it a whip. You can make it a hose. You can make it slice things in half. There's just so much versatility with it that the animators went crazy. Whereas with like the fire, it's like, okay, you make a fireball, you can like make kind of a flamethrower. Sometimes
at the maximum, you can make explosions and lightning.
Or you can do one of my favorite things, which is making like the little fire daggers, which, by the way, we're in the pilot and we wouldn't see those again for a little while. The fire daggers are my favorite because not only is that style of fighting really cool to just kind of watch, but the idea that you're just basically condensing fire into a like... I forget what those are called. Torches. Yeah, it's just fucking torches in your
like
hand.
Little plasma cutters.
Oh, that's so cool.
One of my favorite elements of how they use fire bending in particular is when they use it to not necessarily use the fire as an attack, but to use it to speed up the movements. Like, use it as kind of like a rocket boost to make their kick go faster or make them, like, dart towards somebody. Like, using it as a propellant.
Well, you don't see and you don't see that very often. Azula uses it on occasion. Mm-hmm. And that's just because Azula is a firebending prodigy. She is unbelievably just really fucking good.
Can we just say that the Agni Kai Zuko versus Azula is probably the best fight in the show?
Yeah. You know what? It probably is. I'm going to say that it off the top of my head, yeah, it's probably the best fight in the show. Part of that had to do with not just only the beautiful animation, but also the music that accompanies it, the way that they use sound, the actual, the way that it develops and ends, because it doesn't just end once Zuko goes down. It ends when Katara takes her down.
Yeah, in a very clever way, too. And let's not underestimate the fact that they were literally fighting a broken Azula at that point. And Grey Delisle, oh my god.
Yeah, let's circle back around to Azula, because she is one of
absolutely.
My favorite characters.
Absolutely,
But yeah, so Katara just becomes a total badass as the show develops, which makes me, I'm gonna get a little progressive here. I really like the fact that the women in this show are all just spectacular. Like, there are so many different kinds of strong, interesting women in this show. Between Katara, Toph, Suki, Azula, you have Ty Lee, Mei, even the puppet, the original Bloodbender. Like, you have all these really cool female characters all throughout.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm really happy to see that. That's not something you get often in American animated television, where you just have a bunch of badass women.
And that's because, Michael Dante DiMartino and Brian Koinetsko, I'm probably butchering either of those
just call
names,
them Brike.
Yeah, they went about the way of writing a character the way you should. Disregard gender, write the character, fill the other part in later.
That's not true. That's
not necessarily true, but I mean,
because here's the thing, the fact that they were women played into their lives dramatically.
For some of them, it definitely did. But
for Katara,
there's
Ty Lee, for Mei,
there's a point where you also want to disregard there's a point in character where gender doesn't play a role. And that's the part where you have to be able to say, okay, this is just the human condition. It has nothing to do with gender.
Yeah. And that's
how would they. Yeah.
Then the reason to write a character's gender as part of their life is because no matter what, gender means something culturally. So, we see that matter for Katara. It matters for Toph. It matters for Suki. Because Suki is part of an all-female troupe of fighters. You see all of these different characters, and for some characters, them being male means something. For Zuko, as the prince, his honor, you can see
Sokka.
For Sokka, that plays heavily into his character. Gender politics played a role all throughout Avatar. And that was the thing, and the thing that they were careful about was only on a couple of occasions did they kind of just overstep how they wanted to communicate that. But that it felt like it mattered because, this is a cultural thing. But yeah, and that's a whole other topic. That's a whole thing to go into. Gender politics in Avatar. I just really appreciated the fact that, They
wrote a lot of very strong characters, some of whom happen to be women.
Yes. So you have Katara. Sokka is actually one of my favorite characters in the entire show, just because of how funny he gets, but how also useful and relevant he stays despite the fact that he is not a bender.
There's something that got pointed out, actually, as the series progressed. It's the fact that while Aang was learning all of the nation's elemental, like, you know, attributes, Sokka was picking up part of their military tactics.
Yeah, he was learning about their cultures.
Sokka is the cultural avatar, like the militaristic avatar, learning fighting styles and technologies from around the world in order to better give everybody else a chance when it comes to facing the Fire Nation.
And I loved that. Sokka could have easily been just the annoying, like, he could have been that guy in the Ember Island Players.
Mm-hmm.
Obnoxious, sexist, always talking about food, and just basically useless. And he's not. And I was so happy to see that. I was so happy to see the jokester character in that first season develop as time went on. And by the time we got to season two, he was actually incredibly helpful all throughout, just in terms of, like, hell, he was helpful in season one, where he came up with ways to like, deal with the attack on that Eastern Air Temple.
Mm-hmm.
Like, it was really great to see he was sort of a meathead when it came to people, but strategically, he just studied and learned and picked up on so much. He's a learner.
He's a very valid combatant.
Yes.
And which is proved, I think, the most when he gets his meteor sword.
Oh man, that episode is a weird one.
It's such a cool one though. Sokka's master.
It's really cool. There are two problems I ultimately have with Sokka's master, and I feel like pointing them out because otherwise, it's a really great episode. But one, it literally takes place over a day. Literally over a day. They even say, "In one day," and it's like, "Are you kidding me?"
Yeah, he does master that pretty fucking fast.
Yeah.
Whatever.
And secondly, like, I understand that they wanted to give him the sword and stuff and, teach him something. But, like, leaning into this idea that he wasn't helpful, I'm like...
Yeah, he's been the strategist of the team this whole time.
Yeah, it's like he's actually helped a lot. I mean, yes, he can't bend, and when it comes to a fight, he often needs help. But he's been incredibly helpful throughout, like, those two seasons. Why is it in the third season they decided, like, "Oh, Sokka, you're pretty good for a non-bender. Oh, man, I sure wish I had something that made me stand out. Oh, I'm going to learn how to use a sword." I love the episode. Upon rewatch, I'm like, ooh, this comes out of nowhere.
Yeah, a little bit. It never bothered me too much, except for the part that you mentioned, like where he started feeling inadequate.
Yeah. Which,
when you're standing next to the Avatar, the literal most powerful bender in all the world, hard not to feel a little inadequate. But
yeah, unless you're Toph, in which case you're just the best.
And moving on to Toph, I think the show. Really hits its stride and actually, like, you know, holds you from that point forward when they introduce Toph.
So Toph is a fascinating character because she's static. Unlike all the other characters, she does not have an overarching, like, story that really culminates to anything in terms of her development as a, in her personality.
She has little things.
Yeah.
Learning to, like, it's... For her, her arc was mostly learning how to trust others and, appreciate a family.
Yes.
Basically.
Yeah.
That was her arc. And it's a much smaller arc, but it's there.
Yeah. I mean, it is there. You're right. One does exist for her, but she doesn't exactly tie into the overall story as strongly as those other characters do. Which is actually kind of made a joke of when she gets her own little quote-unquote field trip with Zuko. And she starts to try to do what everyone else has been doing. And Zuko's not having it. And she's like, man, worst field trip ever.
Yeah.
And it's my turn
for a field trip with Zuko.
But
she's full of so many amazing moments that, like, I legitimately think she's my favorite member of Team Avatar.
Between the fact that she's incredibly funny and incredibly powerful.
Yeah, she invents metal bending. I love that part where it's just like, I'm the strongest earthbender ever.
Oh yeah. No, like she just comes out of there and she's like, she's not even surprised. She's just impressed. She's like, man, I really am the fucking best. Don't you fucking forget it. By the way, I like to point out, those two probably died.
It's very, very possible.
She leaves them there, unable to move or do anything on a trail that is specifically out of the way.
I don't think they died because I'm pretty sure at least one of them showed up in the final arc. Because it was the family, like steward and the boulder, right?
You know what? Actually. Shoot, I can't remember. I have to look that up. But no, I think the boulder does come back, but it wasn't the boulder and the family steward. And the family steward doesn't come back, and I don't think the other guy does either.
It was the tournament organizer.
Yeah, it was.
And the steward.
Yes. So, I think they died. I think they might have died.
It's possible. They could have died out there.
Actually, it was on my second rewatch. Oh my god, I have seen the series 4 times through. Oh, wow. I just realized because I watched it with my friend Bryson back when I was living in Lake Charles. Anyway, so yeah, the Toph is the best. She's amazing and I love her.
Toph Beifong is amazing. They gave her a disability, but they write for that disability in such an amazing way.
Between the fact that she's able to use her earthbendings to circumvent that and in fact make her earthbending stronger...
But when it comes to the points of actually, like, making the blind joke, it's like, oh, it's okay, Sokka. I think that painting looks great. Hey.
Why do you do that? No, why do you feel the need to do that?
And oftentimes people will forget that she can't read. She's like, I am blind!
There it is! Is what one of you are going to say when one of you finally spots it. Like, moves the hand in front of her eyes, smiling. I'm like, oh my god, all of these blind jokes, like, you almost want to feel offended, but you know that she's so strong that it doesn't matter, so when she, like, makes all these jokes, like, Jesus Christ.
It's so brilliantly written that, like, it'll catch you off guard sometimes, like, even sometimes while you're watching, you'll forget, oh yeah, she is blind. She's just such a... I don't know. I think she's like the best, I think she's like one of the best written characters in a show full of amazingly written characters.
Yeah.
They kind of allude to her in the first season in the Boggy Swamp episode, I think. Is that in the second season?
That isn't actually in the second season. It's where Aang is. They get dragged down into that swamp, and he has a vision of a girl. And he's like, I think she's supposed to be my earthbending teacher. And yeah, finds, I think in the next episode, actually, they find Toph. So, yeah, no, that, oh man. Toph, so, whereas Katara and Sokka tie very close into Aang's story and, you know, oh yeah, we're leading the charge against the Fire Nation. Toph is just kind of there to be like, yeah, I'll
look, help. You need an earthbending teacher, and I'm the best there ever will be.
There's probably a little bit of pride, like, yeah, I'm going to teach the Avatar how to be an earthbender. I'm going to be that cool. And yeah, I do love how she teaches him. I like how she's like, finally, after Aang gets mad, she's like, all right, now do it. Now hit the rock. And then he breaks it, and she's like, yeah, that's right.
She's also the, like, probably one of the biggest standout parts in The Legend of Korra as well.
Yeah, I think she was all right there. She's in season 4, I believe. Yeah,
it was 4. Whatever the earthbending season was.
Yeah, season 4.
But she just stands out, and she will always be the Melon Lord. Just
hell yeah, Melon Lord. Oh, by the way, there's
Melon Lord, the strongest of all benders.
There's something I gotta bring up about that Melon Lord scene that fucking fucked me up the first time I saw it.
What?
So, they're all fighting the Melon Lord. She's, you know, firing at them. But Aang gets in for the kill, but can't do it. Sokka just walks up, takes out his sword, and cuts the damn thing's head off in half. And it's like, okay. Because there's a visual element there. It's like, Sokka's like, I'll show you how it's done. And you believe it. For that moment where he just goes up there and does it, it's like, yeah, you know what? There's a part of me that thinks that Sokka would just take out his sword and do it.
Well, Sokka knows what's at stake. And yeah. He knows that, like, he... Nobody on Team Avatar knows that he has the capability to literally spirit bend. Because nobody's never even heard of that shit.
Energy bending, but yeah.
Whatever. They call it, don't they call it spirit bending in Korra? That's the nomenclature I know. But nobody knows that he can do that. And so they think, yeah, the only way to stop this is to end him. And Sokka, and this goes into the fact that they just write this show for children in such a mature way. They play with the themes of death a lot.
Yeah.
And I think that's like one of the first times on Nickelodeon that they really do that, especially in a cartoon. But Sokka had lost his mom to the Fire Nation, and his dad has been imprisoned a number of times. So many of his tribe. Yeah. So many of his nation's people have been killed, and so many other people have been killed and suppressed due to this guy that, yeah, sometimes you got to take that step. Just like with, I think the first time they recognize it is with when they go to Kyoshi Island for the first time, and Aang is put on trial for... The trial is much later, but he learns that Avatar Kyoshi once killed a... like this Genghis Khan like dude that was just trying to overtake the entire Earth Nation.
Which I love when Aang is like, but he fell to his own death. And she's like, I don't see the difference.
Yeah, I killed him. I caused it. I was the one that opened that hole that he fell into.
Yeah. And oh man. And then I forget the era. There was Kyoshi, Roku, and I forget what the airbending one was.
You mean the waterbender? The one before?
No, the airbending one that he talks to. The waterbending one is just a fucking... I liked him because he's like, yeah, I was a waterbender, I was a surfer, I was pretty cool, go with the flow. Then my girlfriend got her face stolen.
Yeah, which amazing callback to season one.
Oh yeah, by the way, Ko the Face Stealer, best part of season one. I was actually sad he never came back. Fun fact, in the comics afterwards, there's a huge callback to him. His mom shows up.
Oh.
Yeah, it's pretty cool. But even the airbender is like, oh, kid, you don't get it. You don't get enlightenment. You're the Avatar. Like, you can't.
Yeah, you're not allowed. You have to bear the burdens of everybody.
Yeah. And also, it was really interesting because, so, the entire series is Eastern... philosophy mm-hmm. Inuit, and only one character in the entire thing is Indian, and that's Guru.
The Guru, yeah. The one that's taken over one of the air temples.
Yeah. By the way, that guy, I love that guy. He's great. I love how they talk about, here are your chakras. The whole chakra thing was fascinating, because I really liked when they would go into the mechanics of how bending worked. You use your chi. It's all chi based, so like when they talk about if you get hit by lightning, which by the way only firebenders can do this. I was curious about that, and yeah, only firebenders can do this. You have to channel it down into your stomach and then release it. And I was like, oh, that's so cool. So that's like they're talking about like, oh yeah, that's where your pool of chi is. It's in your stomach, and your chakras are connected all over. And I love that stuff. And that's I miss the Guru. He was cool.
The entire show is just full of those really fun lore expanding and like world widening moments. One of my favorite things in most shonen anime is when they explain how the power works in that world, like Hunter x Hunter with Nen.
I was about to say the best one.
Yeah, the best one. But to other extents would be Chakra and Naruto. Or they do it very lightly, but Ki in Dragon Ball Z. When they explain how the stuff works, it kind of gives you that like visceral feeling that kind of like connects you to that world a little bit more.
Yeah.
Which is like, oh yeah, I can feel it too, you know?
Well, it's sort of interesting because Hunter x Hunter's use of Nen is kind of like this extension of Ki from Dragon Ball. It's like, yeah, look, your muscles are only going to get so big. Your body is only going to get so powerful. It's the energy inside of you that you have to cultivate and work out. You don't see a lot of any of that in Avatar. There's never like, oh yeah, you have to build up your chi so you can attack stronger. No, you just have to get better at all of your stances and your technique and...
That's the thing. With Avatar, it's like, it is about that technique, but no matter how good your technique is, there is still that level of energy that you have within you that you can allow to flow with that element. And it's more about communing with the element than it is just dominating it.
Yeah. And that's why Toph is literally the best earthbender alive.
Yeah, she learned directly from the Badger Moles. The originators of earthbending.
And she is so connected to the earth that it is basically an extension of her very spirit.
I think they explain in Korra that by that point in her life, she can literally see anywhere on the planet where that massive tree's roots are touching, which is everywhere pretty much.
Yeah, she's pretty crazy overpowered at that point.
Which is why she's like, yeah, I'm not gonna involve myself in all this stuff anymore. You guys seem to have this down.
So we've gone over the gang. Zuko, if we can touch back on Zuko for just a minute.
Oh, because, absolutely.
Yeah, like, we can go into the Fire Nation family now. Zuko, oh my god, I love Zuko. Like, what a fantastic character with a fantastic story. Oh my god.
He has the best arc out of anybody. It goes all the way to season 3. Like, he is always developing. Whereas I feel like some characters get stagnant and just kind of stop. He starts in kind of like a static-ish place, but when they introduce the blue spirit and move on past that, it's like, okay, you can start to see him... even as early as episode 2 when he faces Admiral... What's his name?
Zhao.
Yeah, Admiral Zhao in that Agni Kai. It's like, okay, so you can kind of see that he has that honor about him and that Iroh has been fostering that, and his relationship with Iroh is... Oh, my God. Like, the show basically could have been about Zuko and it would have been just as good.
Zuko, yeah, you're right. His development never stops until about near, like, close to the, like, halfway through season 3, he's hit that point. He's like, no.
Yeah, once he's on Team Avatar, it's like, okay, from this point forward, the only development he has left is standing up to those that he's feared.
Yeah, so, you know, when he stands up to Azula and whatnot. But also, as I've said, I've watched this show 4 times through. I still can't not cry when he finally meets back up with his uncle after the eclipse.
Mm-hmm.
That kills me every time. The fact that once Zuko finally apologizes, it's done. It's over. He's not mad anymore. He's never mad. He was just so scared for his nephew. And he just hugs him. And he's like, how could you forgive me so quickly? And it's like, I was never mad. I was just scared. He was scared he was going to lose another son.
It's a beautiful moment. I mean, Iroh is such an amazing character. Made amazing by Mako. Or Mako.
Mako?
Mako. Mako. Yeah. Made amazing by the late Mako. He brings such an air of dignity and respectability, but also aloofness to that character that he makes him whole.
Part of it is the fact that he is so old and he's been around for so long and seen so much that he knows what to take seriously and what not to. He's got that confidence and casualness about him where he's like, hey, I'm going to focus on the things that matter to me.
And Iroh has a moment of passing on just a bit of wisdom to literally every single member of the show.
Yeah.
His moment of sitting down and having tea with Toph is one of my favorites.
Oh, yeah. Oh, my God. And she's like, and she remembers him.
It's like, I met your uncle.
He wouldn't stop talking about you. It was actually kind of annoying, but also pretty sweet. Yeah. Yeah, no, I'm sorry, but... Toph and Iroh hanging out together is like best friends. I just love, I like where Ira's like, you know, that's how you treat somebody you love. Not that I love you, I barely know you, but it's like, oh, you're such a grandpa, I love you.
He's the type of person that I want to be when I'm old. He's the type of person I want to be now, honestly, but I'm nowhere near worldly enough.
Yeah, he's, and throughout the entire series, and also when he becomes buff grandpa.
Oh, yeah.
Buff grandpa.
Like, he knows that dignity only goes so far. He doesn't care about dignity. He cares about, just his own self-honor, like, honoring his own values. Because he'll debase himself in order to make sure that he doesn't have to hurt somebody or that people don't have to get hurt.
Mm-hmm.
And it's just...
I love when he tells
an amazing character.
I love when he tells that guard, you don't look very well. You should go home and get some rest. And she's like, no, I feel fine. No, I think it would be better if you weren't here this evening.
Just warning them, like, shit's about to go down. I promise you, you should go.
Yeah, and oh man, I'm so happy that she just, you know what? Okay, after all this, after the relationship I built with this person, I'm just gonna take his fucking word for it and go the fuck home. I was like, yeah, that's about right. Listen to Uncle Iroh. He's got the good advice.
I think, like, everything kind of, like, hits home in another one of my favorite episodes. The one in season two where it's just everybody having a moment during the day, the compilation episode.
Tales of Ba Sing Se.
Yeah, Tales of Ba Sing Se. It's really the only episode that kind of stands out, the only part of the episode that stands out to me is Iroh's part, just him teaching the mugger how to hold his knife. And it all cultivating in that immensely heartbreaking moment at the tree. It's just...
As I said, I ended up rewatching it twice lately, and again, another segment where I'm like, ah, fuck.
Yeah, every time. I feel my heart break again every time, especially due to the fact that that was also around the time that Mako passed away, and that segment was dedicated to him. Leaves on the vine, man. Leaves on the vine.
All right, so we've talked about Zuko, we've talked about Iroh. Now let's talk about the real villain of the show.
Which some might say Fire Lord Ozai. No,
it's Azula.
Like, Azula, look, yeah, is we can talk the
about
villain.
The, hey, let's talk about the Fire... Like, you know what? Let's talk about the Fire Lord for a moment. He's voiced by Mark Hamill. He looks intimidating. Cool. That's the Fire
Lord.
And he has, like...
Okay, his fight with Aang is pretty cool.
Oh, yeah, no, his fight with Aang is nuts.
But once Aang goes Avatar State, it's literally just a shit stop.
Yeah.
Like, it's almost embarrassing how quickly he is defeated, even with the power of Sozin's Comet.
Yeah. I mean, so, you know, if we're going to talk about that real quick, that fight is spectacular, but it's also really good to mention that he survives against Avatar State Aang way longer than literally anybody else.
An like, Avatar State Aang that did not want to kill him.
Was trying to take him down, though.
Yes, but if he was going with lethal intent, could you imagine?
I don't know, that part where he breaks up the rocks and starts shooting them like bullets. I could believe that he was trying to battle him down to a defeat. And not kill him, but I'm not even sure that lethal force would have managed to do any more or less damage than it did, because the Fire Lord was doing his best to dodge all of that shit.
Mm-hmm.
And it was a really amazing fight against a guy who was definitely bad and strong, and again, voiced by Mark Hamill, so at least it had that going for him. He was a big, intimidating force to be reckoned with.
The Sozin's Comet three-parter is just it's four. The ultimate climax. Four-parter?
Yeah, I think it's four parts, actually.
Oh, man. Either way, it is the ultimate climax to this show, like, everything that led up here, because... Every part that's going on is amazing. You have the fight with Aang and Ozai. You have Zuko, Toph, and Suki or no, not Zuko. Sokka. Jesus Christ, I went to the awful live action movie. Sokka, Toph, and Suki invading the airships, which is amazing in its own right. And of course, you have the amazing battle between Azula and Zuko and Katara. If we can count all the parts, all four parts, that is my favorite episode, but
it's pretty amazing.
Yeah, unfortunately, except for just being this force in Zuko's past, Ozai, yeah, does not really amount to much, whereas Azula is a consistent, immense threat who very much might be strong. Oh wait, I also forgot to mention one other part of that four part, but the White Lotus taking back Ba Sing Se.
Fuck yes, the White Lotus, so good.
Iroh living up to his prophecy of taking Ba Sing Se, not taking it for the Fire Nation, but taking it back for the people.
Yeah. Oh, when he fucking burns the flag. Oh yeah, Iroh, you king.
A firebender can only feel this type of power once every 100 years.
Man, fucking when he starts breathing in and the fire around him starts going up like a fucking audio spectrum, like, I'm like, holy shit.
It's like, oh yeah.
Ugh.
But yes, Azula and Ty Lee and, oh god, I keep forgetting Sokka or Zuko's girl. What's her name?
Oh, Suki.
No, Zuko's.
Oh, Zuko. Oh, May.
May.
Yeah. Which, by the way, I love that May is a very feminine name. Ty Lee is a very masculine name. But Ty Lee is super girly.
Like,
she's hyper girly girl.
Like the most conventionally attractive of the three.
Yeah. Oh man.
As shown in the beach episode, which another amazing standout episode.
By the way, so I was blown away by this. Like when I was watching that, I'm like, okay, those outfits are more revealing than you see in a lot of like animated shows for kids. And apparently Bryke was like, yeah, we actually made them even more revealing in our initial drafts. And I'm like, what?
So that the censors would say, tone that back. Okay.
Yeah, I think that was the idea. It was like, we want them to be able to just be like wear what, well, people wear
people
on
would
the
wear
beach.
At a beach.
Yeah. So, but yeah, that I was like, wow, Ty Lee, hot goddamn girl.
Mm-hmm. And all those guys like hitting on her, and Azula notably getting jealous.
Oh my god, fucking okay. So we should talk about Azula though.
Mm-hmm.
Jesus Christ, what an amazing villain. Maybe one of the best in all of animation. I'm sorry. Holy fuck. Because
such a very human monster.
Because, so, with fucking Ozai, he's just evil for the sake of evil, and he's this big villainous character, and you understand where his motivations come from. He grew up, you know, he grew up with other tyrants. He believes it's his right. And you could see Azula
literally
becoming
his brother.
Oh yeah. Like the fact that he's like, you know, Iroh just lost his son, so maybe we should not have him.
We should go with the guy that has an heir.
Yeah, which by the way, I want to circle back around to that. But Azula is next level. She's like, no, I've learned everything I need to know over the last 15 years of my life. I know exactly how to work people, how to use firebending, how armies work, how our nation works. I know.
Yeah, she is possibly the strongest firebender outside of Ozai. And even then, as a 15-year-old girl, she would no doubt outclass him eventually.
That fight would be... Oh man, I would actually love to see that fight. I can't help but think that she might win if she were in her right headspace.
Which she never really is.
See, we see her, like, the only time she is absolutely outmatched is when it's literally Iroh, Zuko, Aang, Katara, and Sokka backing her into a corner. And then she's like, okay, yeah, even I gotta know when to peace out. Later, bitches. and fucking shoots Iroh with lightning.
Mm-hmm.
Like, that whole scene. Oh my god, she's just... And, yeah, great Eliel. It wouldn't have worked as well without her just giving the performance of a lifetime as this.
She is an amazing Nickelodeon bitch. She plays all the bitch characters on the Nickelodeon cartoons.
I know, right? Oh, and she does such a good job.
Yeah.
Oh, she's so phenomenal. And yeah, I can't get over how much I love Azula. Also, I don't know if you, so when you were watching through again, did you notice that Azula has a theme?
You mean musically?
Yes. Well, she has a motif. She has a motif that plays whenever she shows up.
Yeah. Yeah. I noticed it the last time I watched through it, especially in the scenes in Bossing Say.
Yeah. And it's, I'm not even sure what the instrument is, but it's that.
Yeah. It's almost like a shamisen of some sort. Like, yeah. It's some sort of Asian banjo.
Yeah. And it just plays in the background. And it's like, oh man. I didn't really notice that again until I started rewatching. I'm like, oh, cool. She's got a motif that plays whenever she shows up. And so whenever you hear that music, you know that it ties directly back into her. Mm-hmm. I haven't studied a lot of musical theory, but I do love how music can tie a scene to a character or an event.
Even without them being there.
Yes. I think that is amazing. The music throughout Avatar is actually kind of up and down. I think sometimes it's cheap and lame. I think there are some times that the music is just, okay, you just needed something to pad out this scene, whatever. But there times where it's fucking gorgeous. Yeah.
Notably in very key moments.
Yeah.
But it runs into the same issue that a lot of shows like this do, including like many anime. It's that they have like a selection of songs. It's like, what do we have? Oh, well, this song will fit here. This song will fit here. This song will fit here.
Mm.
And you kind of run into that a lot, especially in early season one, where they probably wanted to spend a lot more of their budget on the animation than they did the music. Which, can I point out that this show only won one singular Emmy for animation?
Are you fucking kidding me? It's all ruined. It's all bullshit.
Yeah, and it wasn't even for outstanding animation or anything. It was for individual achievement for Sangjin Kim for Lake Logai. Laogai. But it never won specifically. I don't know what competition it was running into, but holy shit.
Yeah, nah, that is bullshit. But... Okay, so we've talked about all the things that we love about the show. The anime... Oh, by the way, I don't think we've spoken enough about the animation. The animation's gorgeous. Holy fucking shit.
I also don't think we've gone nearly enough into Azula at all, really.
We could go more into Azula. Like, the fact that she obviously has a huge mother, like, complex about her mother. Which, oh man. Like, just the glimpses at that you see speak volumes about her character and how she developed.
She has an immense inferiority complex despite being the strongest. Like
part of the reason she became the strongest was that like she had problems with her personality, which affected her relationship with her family, and then she internalized that into like, fuck it. If they don't love me for who I am, then I'm just gonna double the fuck down, both in my personality and my strengths.
And while it's not outright stated, I think it also has something to do, like going back to what you were saying about it being kind of a male dominating society, and how Zuko is kind of seen universally as the heir, where she is definitely the more rightful heir in terms of like power.
Yeah, I mean, you want to talk about who is stronger, it's Azula.
Yes,
but it's actually,
definitely. Although it's kind of hard to say, in their final Agni Kai, even though she had kind of a shattered mental state by that point, because she just has she has an inability to form attachments or any trust. She is the definition of a non-functioning sociopath. She probably would have lost to Zuko in that fight if she had not turned on Katara.
Oh yeah, she would have. She was about to lose. That's the only reason that she attacked Katara. which at that point made her lose the Agni Kai, but she was just going to kill them both anyway, so what does it matter?
Yeah. She even tried to get rid of, like, the two twin ladies that were... Or, no, one of them. Actually, yeah, it was kind of a funny scene. I can't remember their names, but, like, number one, you're fired. Number two, you come with me. But I'm number one.
Yeah. And, that was... I loved those characters, too. Just old, like, the old grandmas. They were great.
As she slowly shatters, specifically once the label of Fire Lord is placed on her and pressure actually hits her.
Yeah, and it came at the worst time for her. If Ty Lee and Mei hadn't betrayed her, I think she would have grown to become an unstoppable monster. But I think it was after losing the only people that she trusted, and she did trust them.
Mm-hmm. They were her friends.
Yeah. After losing
the things that she considered friends.
Yeah. The only people that she... Like, even after that, after it all starts crashing down, she even starts to not trust her father. So at that point, it's like, wow, yeah, no, she needed those last remnants of friendship and trust. And once they were gone, nope, she just spiraled.
She couldn't trust anything.
Yeah, she spiraled immediately and horribly, and oh my god. Yeah. And like when Zuko goes up there and he's like, I can take her. What? But you said she's too strong. No.
Something's wrong. I got this.
And he was right. If Katara wasn't there, it's funny. If Katara wasn't there, he would have won. But because Katara was there, they won.
Yeah. But just in a different way.
Yeah. Which, by the way, like, every time I rewatch that fight, I'm like, this is so great. Like, her noticing the waterways and, like, I just need to get her in here. Once she's in here, she's mine. And, oh, also...
And the final breakdown where she's just, like, chained to the water grates, screaming, crying, breathing out fire. It's such a powerful moment.
It is the darkest scene in the entire show. Like, it is dark as hell. It is sad as hell. Watching that is just hard.
It's darkly heartbreaking.
Because you, in that moment, you see not Azula, the monster that tracked them down, but just this broken girl. She's not even an adult. She's just broken from, you know, her family thinking she's a monster. Her only friends abandoning her. Like her whole world view being challenged and destroyed in that moment.
Are we ever given any info what happens to her afterwards? Like, I know there's a whole sequel comic that I never read.
Yeah. Okay, look, people are gonna disagree with me. I read through all of them. They're not good.
Oh.
I do not like them. And I don't think they're good. Let me restate that. I do not think they are good. I think they are bad. I think there are good elements throughout them, but I think as stories, they're awkwardly told. I think the dialogue is not good, and I think that what they did with Azula was the absolute worst. Oh my god.
But it is what happens canonically. What does happen to her?
Oh my god. Okay, so... Okay, spoilers for the comics. If you guys haven't seen them, I'll try not to go over too much of them, but... They take her out of prison to go find Zuko's mom.
I know that's what the subject material was. But...
And then they try to put her under house arrest, and then she becomes a villain again.
Hmm.
And a really dumb villain. A really bad villain.
Amazing that they wouldn't just have her bending removed.
You know what? You'd think that they'd go to Aang and be like, yo, get rid of her fire bending. Like, she's obviously as bad as my father.
She's too dangerous.
Yeah, she's obviously as bad as her father. I mean, that's obvious. At face value, even if she's mentally unstable, that's almost worse. It's like, okay, no, she needs her bending taken away. She's a danger to herself and others. But nope, that's not what happens. And I, again, what they do with Azula is really bad. Some other characters get some neat stuff, like Zuko's development's kind of interesting, but Azula's is really awful, and I'd like to think that the comics don't exist.
Hmm. Canonically speaking, does Aang really only remove the bending of two characters? Ozai and whoever...
Yakone.
Okay, Yakone. That's what it was. I know it was... what's his name's brother?
Yeah. It's canonically, yes. By the way, okay, so... I really want to touch on that real quick, because here's a huge problem I have with the show.
Okay.
So, the energy bending shit is bullshit. It's an interesting idea, and they could have made it work, but the way they did it sucked. As rewatching through the show four times, the first time I saw it, I was like, what the hell is going on? The second time I saw it, I'm like, okay, I get it now. But the third and fourth time, I'm like, okay, yeah, no, this did not get better on repeat viewings. They did not build up to it enough. They only really got into it in the last five episodes. And the fact that it is so very, very barely talked about and covered, no, the energy bending stuff sucked. Because
the one thing I can kind of help to kind of like brush that away and explain it away is like, it doesn't seem like any of the other avatars knew that that was a capability either.
No, it doesn't seem that they did.
Except for like maybe way back when. Although you think Avatar, what was it, Wan?
Wan. Yeah, Wan.
Yeah, you think Avatar Wan might be able to commune, but I don't know.
I don't want to. If we ever want to do a follow-up, if Korra ever gets on Netflix, we'll talk about Korra.
I kind of hope it does. I actually, like, it's not as good. It's not as good, but I enjoy Korra.
Are you kidding me? I've been trying to rewatch. I want to rewatch Korra. I have it on Blu-ray, but I don't really have a Blu-ray player except for my PS4. That's over in the living room. I would kill for it to be on Netflix so I can put it on in the background when I do my workouts. Because, goddammit, I want to rewatch Korra. I may not like Korra as much as Avatar The Last Airbender, and in fact, some places I actively dislike it, including the Wan stuff, but I want to rewatch it because there were parts I really loved, and I'd like to see that now that it's a couple of years after, I want to see whether or not I've changed how I initially felt.
I like the Wan stuff. If not only because the, like, definitive shift in animation style, but I do like that kind of like world building and lore building.
Here's the thing. If I can just touch on why I didn't like that, it ruins the Avatar for me because it makes it a completely, it like, whereas originally it felt like, oh no, the Avatar has a place in the universe in it. Like it basically, oh yeah, no, the Avatar is the bridge. He is supposed to exist, or well, they are supposed to exist. No, actually, by all rights, there shouldn't be an Avatar. The Avatar interfered with the natural order, then had to, like, basically give himself over to... By the way, and Rava and Vatu are bullshit.
Oh, yeah, no, I did not like that part. Yeah, I did not like the anti-tar.
Yeah, that's not how yin and yang works. God damn it, Bryke, you're usually so good about this, and yet you completely fucked up how yin and yang work. How did you do that? But yeah, no, like, Vatu and Rava suck. They're one of the worst parts about Avatar. The fact that, oh yeah, people got bending from the Lion Turtles also sucks. Like, I hate that. I hate all of that. They took all the interesting, like, oh yeah, no, people are benders and some aren't, and this is how, like, they just develop. They learn from the fucking badger moles, and nope. They stole it from the fucking turtles, and the Avatar is actually not supposed to exist. God damn it, I don't like any of that. Ugh. But yeah, anyways, I didn't like the energy bending stuff because it kind of came out of nowhere and it just felt like, oh, yep, we need a way for him to not kill the Fire Lord. And it's like, damn it, you could have made that really interesting. It proposed this truly legitimately interesting question of, can he kill, like, they tell you, no, you have to kill the fucking Fire Lord. And then it's like, how is Aang supposed to deal with that? Oh, he just magics his way out of it. He fucking, at the last minute, what's the fucking term for that? Deus ex machinas. Or deus ex, or so, no, you, so Lion you don't, so King you ex machinas.
So you'd almost rather it be kind of handled in the way that Mob Psycho 100 handles those dilemmas. Where it's just, I mean, like, I'm strong enough to withstand this stuff. Please let's talk this out.
By the way, I meant turtle, lion, turtle, ex machina. But yes, I well, you know, no, because I don't think that would have been, with the Fire Lord, I don't think he was there to be talked down to. I don't think there was any way of, like, stopping him other than just beating him. Although I will point out, like, look, they leave other benders alive often in Korra, and they left Azula without her bending. Why did we have to kill the Fire Lord? Just take him down, throw him in prison, make sure he can't use his firebending anymore, and it's done. Is he really that dangerous? Azula seems more dangerous.
It's maybe the fact that he has loyalists, like very strong loyalists that would probably not keep him in prison.
Actually, that is another part of the comic where, because here's the thing, does it matter if he has his fire or not?
It kind of does. Although without the comet, it's less of a threat.
Yeah. Point being, like, look, I also think that tyrannical despots need to be put down. I'm sorry, he was in charge of a lot of people's death, destruction, the ruination of cultures. Yeah, no, like, I'm not pro-death penalty necessarily, but that guy needed to be taken down. He needed to just, like, yep, yeah, sorry, yeah, genocided a people, bye.
Like, yeah.
I think the avatars were right. No, when it comes down to it, you gotta be able to pull the trigger on that one. But the whole dilemma was like, okay, but they didn't have to do that with Azula, and she was just as much of a danger as her father. There's a whole thing. There's, you know what? It was still an interesting question.
The thing with Aang, like, dealing with the Fire Lord as he did, which I do think it was set up a bit better than you think it was set up. I agree to disagree there, I think. But I think it plays so much better to the theme of Aang and, like, what the Avatar, like, represents to him and what he believes it should represent. He doesn't, like, he is a pacifist. He doesn't want to kill, and he found a way to peacefully do it in a way that is both very powerful, something that no other person on that planet could do. And in essence of, like, if, you know, bending is literally just using your soul and communing it with nature in order to manipulate the elements, does theoretically make sense that you'd be able to do it with somebody else's energy and spirit as well?
Oh, I don't think energy bending is bullshit. I think energy bending as an idea is really cool. I just didn't like how it was implemented at all. I just didn't like the fact that it's like, Aang's got this huge conflict, and suddenly he meets the Lion Turtle, and the Lion Turtle's like, hey, here's the thing you could do. And then he comes back and it's like, oh yeah, by the way, I learned this from the Lion Turtle off screen, basically. So,
No, he didn't learn it off screen. He booped him on the nose.
Yeah, he booped him. He's like,
Him on the nose. Now he knows the Kaioken and the Spirit Bomb.
But yeah, no, that's why I love Avatar The Last Airbender, one of my favorite series. That ending is bullshit. All of the ending, just that part of it. That part of it with the energy bending is bullshit. But that's cool. That's fine.
Yeah.
You know what?
I'll agree to disagree with you on some of that. I do think he learns it a little too quickly. I personally like the implementation of the Lion Turtle. I think it looked really, I think it was just like a really cool, like, oh shit, like there's parts of this world that, like, even still are kind of a mystery. I like that.
Also, apparently, and I say apparently, I don't know this 100%. Apparently, there was supposed to be another season, which actually, when you watch that third season, you're like, oh yeah, Sozin's Comet was supposed to be a fucking finale.
Yeah.
Like, they have two finales in that season. The mid-season finale with Sozin's Comet, and then, not Sozin's Comet, the Eclipse. Yeah, sorry, with the Eclipse. Midway through that season, you have the Eclipse, and then, oh, here's the actual finale later on. But that being said, apparently there was supposed to be a whole other season where they were going to actually engage and explore all the stuff with, the spirit, energy bending and whatnot.
Well, that would have been more interesting. Maybe get some more info from the guru.
Oh, apparently the fourth season thing is crap. Even the creators said no. Okay, maybe it's not. Maybe it's not true. Maybe that fourth season. Maybe it wasn't supposed to be four seasons where they actually look into the energy bending stuff. I don't know.
Well, rumors happen. Either way, let us know what you thought about Avatar. What were some of your favorite episodes? What were some of your favorite characters and moments? Down in the comments if you're watching on YouTube, if you're here live. Hi, everybody. I'm looking at your chat right now. And if you're listening on iHeartRadio or Spotify or Google Play or iTunes or whatever, we're happy to have you there as well. Thank you so much for joining us for the TalkCast Pod Show. We will see you guys next time. Later, everybody.
I'm not done talking about Avatar. God damn it.
How could you be?